Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we try to explore different aspects of the music world. And for this week, we, of course, bring you This Week in Music History.
Da-da-da.
And to help me along with this process is Jacob Crum.
How are you today, Brian?
And Greg Harvey.
Salutations.
I'm doing quite well, Jake, actually.
Good to hear it.
And if you want to make me feel even better, you can help us out by going to our website, followthesoundpodcast.com, and clicking on the Amazon banner. It will take you to Amazon. You can do all your normal shopping, and it won't cost you anything extra, but we get a little bit of money back for everything that you buy. For every purchase that you make, we get a little bit of money. So it's really nice, and it helps us out, and it would put an even bigger smile on my face tonight if that actually happened. So go to the website, followthesoundpodcast.com, click on the Amazon banner, or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. All right, folks, this week in music history, we've got a lot of stuff to get through tonight. Some really interesting little factoids, some mildly entertaining facts.
Some minute points in history.
Some tiny, tiny little details that don't matter. But if you like music history, then this is the show for you. I know there might be some other music history podcast out there, but never will you find another music history podcast like ours that has three people who are mainly talking about things that happened before they were born.
Oh, yeah.
That's what we are. So, starting off this week, we have September 4th through September 8th, and I am going to get this thing started.
Oh,
with Jacob Crum.
Hey, all right. Here we go. September 4th, 1944. Gene Parsons of the Byrds is born in Mungoro Valley, California. Parsons was already a veteran musician when he joined the Byrds in 1968 and was influential in the group's run at country music. With Parsons' connection in Nashville, it was quite easy for them to line up gigs and studio time. But when the band played the Grand Ole Opry in March of 68, they were met with boos from the audience who objected to hippies playing country music.
Interesting.
Yes.
Hippies playing country.
So in 1973, Parsons actually left the Byrds while they were gearing up, while they were in England, finished a British tour, and they were gearing up for a tour of South Africa. And he then joined a 20-year or so musical protest of the apartheid government in South Africa.
Weird.
Yes. So apparently, from what I was reading, the Byrds had been given some kind of assurances from the promoters of this South African tour that they were going to play shows that were not segregated. And so the rest of the band was kind of on board with it. Parsons, however, was not. So he quit the band and stayed in England. The band went on to do that tour, and it was a complete disaster because they were replacing a couple of members, like at the last minute, Parsons included. So their drummer didn't know a whole lot of the songs. It was already going to go bad. And then, to top that off, as soon as they looked at their very first audience, they realized, oh, this show is completely segregated. The audience is segregated by actual walls at the venue.
Oh, wow.
Because apartheid government, assholes, and that's how they tried to roll it.
Wow.
So Parsons quit the band and went and actually stayed with Mick Jagger in his West Sussex home, and later in 1985, played drums on Mick Jagger's first solo album, She's the Boss.
Cool.
So, happy birthday to Gene Parsons. He's still with us.
Yeah.
Happy birthday, Gene.
Moving on up to another great little tidbit here. In 1952, Gladys Knight and the Pips formed. And they formed at the birthday party for Gladys's brother, Bubba.
Good old Bubba.
So, like, they all sang happy birthday, and they thought, wow, that sounded really good.
It's kind of amazing how many random bands actually started at just weird parties where they happen to meet.
Hmm.
Crosby, Stills, and Nash met at a party, and it was like, I think it was Nash was the one who was the third one to show up. The other two were already singing, and then Nash, like, kind of jumped in with, like, another like harmony part or something and just like completed that sound. And then that's exactly how they formed their band. So
wow.
Gladys Knight and the Pips, congratulations for going as long as you did and producing some fantastic music.
Well, that also means that it's her brother Bubba's birthday today, too. So happy birthday, Bubba. Happy birthday, Bubba.
So, moving on from a nice, happy moment, we're moving on to another horrible moment. When, in 1957, Jerry Lee Lewis files for divorce from his second wife, he then marries his cousin Myra 3 months later before it's actually finalized.
Now, we're going to get into a little tiff here because I think that that's a really good moment for Jerry's second wife.
That is a very good moment for Jerry's second wife.
Because that guy was a complete asshat.
Yes.
Wow.
That is true.
And then he marries his cousin, and I didn't know that he wasn't even divorced yet, so he was still married when he married his cousin.
And of course, I mean, this was the cousin Myra, who of course was the youngin.
Yes, 14?
Like 13 or 14, yeah. Like when they actually like got married. It's just such a horrible thing. Just a horrible thing to do.
So, like, at what age does your mind flip that switch where you're like, suddenly this is okay with me? Like, now I want to know so I can be ready, you know? So, I can mentally prepare to stop myself.
Yeah. I do not know.
Mm-hmm. I think it's, I think it's at the cross. I don't know.
I think when my vision starts to go and I get dementia. I don't know. Anyways.
Jake, I think you've got to do this next one, actually.
Yeah, okay, this is my pick for, like, the weird news story in the show, right? So, 1965, The Who, the inventors of stadium rock, have a van full of equipment that they don't want to go missing. So they send their managers to go shopping for a guard dog, because apparently that's what you do. Hmm. So, while The Who's managers are out shopping at the Battersea Dogs home, their van is broken into.
Jeez.
And the van and the equipment are stolen. Later, the van is found. Not all of the equipment. It's somewhere near... The estimate value of their equipment at the time was somewhere near 5,000 pounds.
Which is astronomical at that time, so...
That's a lot of money. Yeah, I don't know what the conversion rate was in 65. It's probably not as good. I'm sure that the pound was more deflated in 65 than it is now.
I don't know. I can Google it if you want.
Well, you go ahead and do that. This is like 23 years after World War II, so it couldn't have been great. Anyhow, but after hearing the story in a newspaper and smelling potential sales opportunity, a representative for Marshall Amplification called Pete Townsend to talk about replacing their Vox system with new Marshall amps.
Yeah.
And Townsend had told them they had tried Marshall amps before, but they just weren't powerful enough to carry the noise of the crowd. And at the time, the biggest Marshall amp you could get was a combo amp that was like 50 watts.
Yeah, okay.
So this Marshall rep, a couple months later, shows up on their doorstep with two 100-watt amps heads and two 8x12 stacks.
Sweet.
One for Entwistle, one for Townsend, and the Marshall stack was born because somebody stole The Who's equipment.
Wow. That was a great story, dude.
And to close out your story,
yes.
5,000 pounds in 1965 would be the equivalent of 91,000 pounds today.
Well, okay, that's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money. So there you go.
Wow. So there you have it. Almost twice the inflation.
It's a very good story, Jake.
Yay, nice job, Jake.
Oh, you want to do the next one, Greg?
Okay, hold up. Real quick footnote. They did not get a dog because the people at Battersea Dogs Home told them you couldn't leave a dog in a van.
Well, that's true. You can't leave a dog in a van.
Hire a guard dog and lock it in the van.
Yeah, that was the plan.
That would not fly these days.
What else are you going to do with the dog? Are you going to take pictures of the dog and put it on the back and say, don't steal our stuff because we have a dog?
And somebody's going to try and rescue the dog and the dog will bite their head off. Jeez. Okay, so here's a fun one. In the year 1969, the film Easy Rider, starring Jack Nicholson, Peter Fonda, and Dennis Hopper, opened at the Classic in London, England. Guys, Easy Rider fans?
I am. It's a depressing film, but yeah, it's a good one.
It's consistently listed as like one of the top 20 classic films of all time.
Yeah, and for good reason. The soundtrack was amazing.
Wow, yeah. Mm-hmm. Our soundtrack podcast, I think, didn't that make one of our lists? It might have been one of the honorable mentions.
Been an honorable mention, yes. But I don't think it didn't make my list. I know that much.
That's true. It didn't make mine either. So, anyways, the movie soundtrack, of course, featured the band, the Jimi Hendrix Experience, and Steppenwolf.
Yeah, with that.
Born
to be wild. Yeah.
Born to be, what was it?
Wild.
Born to be free. Born to be alive. What was that song called?
Born to be wild.
Born to be... Yeah, I know. It's something like that. Somebody stop me here, please.
I'm going to stop you because I'm moving on to the next one. Here we go. In 1976, Fleetwood Mac goes to number one on the U.S. album charts with their self-titled album after being on the charts for over a year. The album went on to sell over 5 million copies in the U.S. and was the first of three number one albums for the group. Of course, this was the album that was done before Rumors. So this was the one before like they actually hit like superstardom. But a funny thing, Jessica and I were going through like our albums and we were kind of organizing some stuff. And she starts pulling out her Fleetwood Mac albums because, as I've said before, my wife is a huge Lindsey Buckingham fan. So she's like, you know, Fleetwood Mac self-titled, Fleetwood Mac self-titled, Fleetwood Mac self-titled, Rumors, Rumors, signed copy of Rumors. It's like Tusk. Like, you pull this out, pull that out, pull it. And I'm just like, good Lord. It's like she's got like a triplicate of like every Lindsey Buckingham album out there. It's like even random albums that like Lindsey recorded on. And so it just cracks me up. So, but this album, while it is good, and it does feature a couple of songs from the Buckingham Nicks album, which I am a big fan of, it is not my favorite Fleetwood Mac album. Rumors is still my favorite Fleetwood Mac album.
It sounds to me like Jessica has your household's version of like the fine china that's just for guests. Like, oh no, this album is just for when we have fancy company. We put on that vinyl.
So we do have a bunch of signed albums and stuff too, which is pretty cool because we're actually going to go through and start hanging stuff up on the walls now too. So it'll be good. I'm looking forward to
one of the best ways to decorate album covers ever.
Yes, 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 yes. All right, and to round out this day for us, I know we're only stopping in the 80s, but sometimes you just don't get that much music history going on into the 90s and 2000s and our current decade. So
it could also be said that there's nothing that can follow up this story.
That is true. So how about you give it to us?
All right, then. The Steve Miller Band takes number one with Abracadabra. It may surprise you to know that Steve Miller says that the song is about Diana Ross, who he met on the set of Hullabaloo 20 years earlier.
Huh?
Yes. But regardless of the strange origins, Capitol Records did not believe in the song and would not release it as a single. In fact, they refused to do so. However, Steve Miller also had a contract with Phonogram Records in Europe, and it was released in Europe, and he went on tour to support the song because it hit number one. Following that tour, Capitol Records released it in the U.S.
What's that? It's a huge hit somewhere else in the world? And we told you it was terrible?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of Steve Miller Band fans would probably say that song is terrible.
Well,
I don't even know it.
Abra, abra, cadabra, I want to reach out and grab you. Abra, abra, cadabra.
This was used that? In that one movie.
Abracadabra.
It was used on one of the Steve Carell movies where he plays a magician.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Round and round, round it goes, where it stops, nobody knows that really annoying chorus.
Do they do like the head movements and stuff too?
I don't know. But there's a song about Diana Ross's underwear later in that song, according to Steve Miller.
Interesting.
Really?
It's weird. It's weirdly interesting.
Yeah, it starts out, I heat up, I can't cool down. So apparently on the set of Hullabaloo, Steve Miller was all about Diana Ross.
Yeah, I know. Just the name Hullabaloo makes you think there's some shenanigans. What is going
on? All right. So
anyway,
here we go. Moving on. September 5th. So this was also tying in with what I was talking about before with Fleetwood Mac. But I'll tell you how in just a little bit. So 1939, born on this day, is Jon Stewart. Not the comedian who we know from, the Daily Show, right?
Yes.
That's what he did for like a long time. But he is the singer and songwriter from the Kingston Trio. He was also a solo artist, had a bunch of different things. But the funny thing is that he actually wrote the Monkees hit Daydream Believer.
No.
Really?
Yes. So John Stewart died at the age of 68 when he suffered a massive stroke and brain aneurysm in San Diego on the 19th in January 2008. Jessica has a couple of signed John Stewart albums, like some really good ones. And there's a reason why. John Stewart played banjo.
Yes.
And a young kid in California learned how to play guitar listening to John Stewart play banjo. And so he learned how to play fingerstyle picking on guitar.
Would that man be Lindsey Buckingham?
Lindsey Buckingham then goes on to join Fleetwood Mac, become super huge and famous. John Stewart then wants to go solo and he wants to play guitar. Upon hearing Lindsey's style of playing, he goes, wow, that's an interesting style. I think I could play like that too. Learns how to play guitar listening to Lindsey Buckingham. So John Stewart played banjo, taught Lindsey how to play. Lindsey played guitar, taught John how to play guitar in this weird circle.
And they were both just congratulating each other.
Later on,
so good.
Later on, when they found this out, is because they actually met. They met at this place. I don't remember where. My wife would be able to tell you. But they basically, Lindsey was just like, man, I am a huge fan of yours. I learned how to play guitar listening to you. And then John was like, that's funny. I learned how to play guitar listening to you.
Wow.
So then there's that. Wow. So Lindsey and Stevie ended up actually helping John out with his solo career and like really, really kind of help him get produced and stuff like that. Lindsey played on a couple of tracks with him. Just super cool stuff. But yes, it was a very sad day when he died. My wife was legitimately sad when he died. But at the same time, she did get to meet him. And got his album signed by him and all that kind of stuff. And got Lindsey to sign it, too. So that was kind of an amazing thing as well. So
wow.
That's on my wall. That's in a frame on the wall.
Happy birthday, John Stewart.
Happy birthday, John Stewart. You will be missed. Going. 1946, Jake. What you got for me?
Ooh, are you a Buddy Miles fan, Brian?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, well, I am.
All right, I was going to say, if you're not, you might be after this, because 1946, Buddy Miles is born George Allen Miles Jr. in Chicago, Illinois. At age 12, Buddy began playing in his father's band, the Bebops. His father was a jazz bassist and played with a couple of guys you might have heard with, like, I don't know, Duke Ellington? You ever hear that guy?
Yes, I heard him.
So he's come from good stock. And anyway, a little family member after the tour, or a family member after the tour, began referring to young George as our little Buddy Rich, and the nickname stuck. You probably know Buddy Miles from the Electric Flag, Black Flag, very different band, and also Jimi Hendrix Band of Gypsies, the precursor to the Jimi Hendrix Experience. He also played a lot with Norah Jones and has like insane studio creds. George Clinton, Parliament, and Funkadelic, all separately and together and in different years. Living Color, Carlos Santana, a whole lot. Buddy Miles died of heart disease in 2008 and with his family at his side. He was asked in an interview in 1995 for American Music Magazine how he would like to be remembered. And Buddy said this. He said he'd like to be remembered as the baddest of the bad. People say I'm the baddest drummer. If that's true, thank you, world.
Wow.
Wow. I like that one. That was
and
good.
And if you have not heard Them Changes, you should do that.
I'll check it out.
It is amazing. It's recorded like right after he... There's a whole like movie of the early Jimi Hendrix years that hasn't been told. Buddy was a huge part of that. When he was playing in Jimi Hendrix Band of Gypsies, Buddy was actually the lead singer of the band.
Ah.
But anyhow, so he left after that. There's a whole big mess of like record companies struggling for control and Jimmy trying to keep control of his art and really nuts. But anyway, when the band dissolved and Buddy left, he went on to do his first solo album right after that. That was his first project. And you can really hear the influence that Jimmy had on him. Like even the intro to a lot of the songs are these weird like kind of spacious, just noise intros before it gets into the groove. And it's this insane fusion of like funk and jazz with like these weird solo breaks that sound like rock, like what we call rock now. But at the time, the only people that were playing that was Jimmy and like... Anyhow, check it out.
Will do.
Miles' first solo album.
Go ahead and do the next one, Greg.
Okay.
1946.
Who is that?
September 5th. Just read it. Just read it. You just got to read it out loud, not in your head.
Farouk Bulsara?
Sure. Let's go with that.
Who is that?
Go ahead and read it.
Is born in Zanzibar, which, of course, is off the coast of Africa.
Yes.
He later takes the name Freddie Mercury.
Yep.
After the Roman messenger to the gods and becomes the front man for Queen. Who the heck? Farouk Bulsara? I've never
heard. You've never heard his original name?
No.
I've never heard anyone say it. Only ever read it.
And he's from Zanzibar?
Yeah.
Freddie Mercury's from Zanzibar?
Yeah. Which is kind of funny, because wasn't he also considered Asian?
Huh? What?
I think everyone tries to claim Freddie Mercury.
Well, that's not true. I know the white people try to steal him, but...
I never knew that. This is probably the most interesting fact we might have ever had on this show. I mean, I could be completely oblivious here.
I mean, if you asked me what Freddie Mercury's name was at birth, I would not have been able to pull like Farouk off the top of my head.
It's Farrokh.
Yeah, I think that's Farouk. I'd say
it's probably Farouk.
Well, it might not even be pronounced the way we think it is.
Or Farouk. I mean, it could be either one.
Boy, there's some
Farouk
Queen.
Bulsara.
There is a Queen fan out there really mad at us right now.
Oh, who cares?
I love Queen. We can talk about Queen, but we need to keep moving. So
well, I'm currently reading up on his parents, actually.
Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, like it's kind of funny because there is like a group of people who are talking about how he is like technically Asian. So that's funny. But either way, we can go ahead and move on to the next one, which is very much a white person thing.
Oh, all right, go for it then, because you're the whitest person here.
That's true. I'm not tan right now at all. In 1956, Elvis Presley surprised his mother with a gift of a pink Cadillac. The car remained in the Presley family and eventually went on display at Graceland.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there's a ton of pictures of him standing with that pink Cadillac. I mean, like, just a ton of them.
Famous.
So I'm pretty sure I've used one of them before, like, for the cover of our show several months ago. But yeah, it's just a pink Cadillac. That's all it is.
That's Americana, and it's pure.
Best car
form.
I ever owned was a Cadillac. 87 Cadillac Sedan DeVille. Blue leather interior, white exterior. It was a land boat, and I loved it.
I can't believe you've already owned a Cadillac. It's like you've already peaked.
Bought it from an old lady down the street for like $3,000 or something, and it had like 40 or 50,000 miles on it.
That's great. That's
like
a great
total.
Deal. Yeah,
like she literally just drove it to the store and then back, and like that was it for like 20 years.
Well, when I hear pink Cadillac, I'm thinking like Bruce Springsteen. I'm thinking like
I'm thinking Mary Kay car.
Well, I was gonna say or Mary Kay. Like, which came first, Mary Kay or Elvis Presley?
Probably Elvis Presley. I don't know.
I don't know, though. I wouldn't. Mary Kay, I feel like, would be around for a while.
It's an instant. It's an American institution.
They're both American institutions, damn it. Oh, no.
This next one, I think, requires an official radio voice.
Go. So, you want me to do it?
Whoever wants to do radio voice.
I can. I'll do radio
Knock
voice since he did the Farouk one before. Let's see. In 1966, John Lennon leaves the English shores to begin principal photography on How I Won the War in Germany. That's not How I Won the War in Germany. It's How I Won the War in Germany. The two separate phrases.
Where it was filmed.
Yes, where it was filmed. If one thing can be said about the film is that it's British. The backdrop for the story is a rough outline of the North Africa campaign and the crossing of the Remagen Bridge. Remagen? I'm totally butchering this, in 1945. But the uniquely British way of understanding things to absurdism. See, this is why I don't let Jake just randomly write notes and things.
Yeah.
And then I don't read ahead, because I totally should have read ahead of time what I was getting into.
Yeah, you should.
Because there's literally a note there that says, throw it to Jake.
Yeah, duh.
Okay. Throw it to Jake.
Yeah.
Jake, okay, here, so, catch this.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so how I won the war. Has anyone else seen any of it?
I have not seen it. I have only seen clips of it.
Okay, all right. I can't sit through it.
Yeah.
It's really bad slapstick comedy.
It's a dark comedy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it is.
It's not, like, humorous. It's just, it's a dark comedy.
Yeah, I would argue that it's funny. There's humor there.
There's some, yeah. You know?
But it's that weird British, like, understatement of things of, like, there's literally a guy getting cut in half by a machine gun, and someone's like, well, I'm sure he's had better days.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that understatement to, you know, ad absurdum.
It's just dry.
However,
humor.
I'd like to point out that so John Lennon went and filmed this in 1966.
Yes.
The film didn't come out till 68 because post-production had scheduling conflicts with some other British actors. And by the way, John Lennon's like acting in this. There's some scenes that are really atrocious. Like, they're bad. They're not good. And this guy was like, I mean, they used his name really to promote the film. Anyway, there's a reason Hollywood didn't go calling for him. Okay, so he is in the film. He plays this private, and he wears round granny glasses in 1966. First time he's ever worn them. I went and looked. I can't find him wearing granny glasses before this movie.
Mm.
Okay, now, also in the film, there are pastel soldiers that have face paint and clothes to match, all monochromatic. This movie is just so mind-numbingly dumb. Okay, so here's my point. All right, so Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, right? All the imagery of it is stolen from this movie.
Like, if we watch the movie,
Watch the movie, you'll watch it, and you'll be like, oh my God, John Lennon is a fucking hack.
He just took everything from the movie.
He took the glasses that he wore because they put his picture on the cover of Rolling Stone, like, while they were shooting the movie.
Mm.
And just went, this is my identity now.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Well.
Okay. All right, fine.
I get it. I get it. I always kind of assumed that he wore glasses anyway, and
he usually wore Buddy Holly horn-rimmed glasses in all the photos I've ever seen of him.
If he is wearing glasses, actually.
Yeah.
But if he's most of the time he's not wearing glasses, right, because that wasn't the image that they wanted to portray.
Right.
Which is kind of funny, because before him there was Buddy Holly and Roy Orbison,
right.
who pulled it off pretty darn well. Although Roy Orbison wore sunglasses, so that was a little bit different.
Right. But either way, I mean, you know, publicity, like every photo of the Beatles
is done by a professional
photographer. So anyhow.
Yeah, exactly.
So. Anyway, that's how I won the war. I can't even describe it. I would have to, like, it would be a thesis to try and describe the movie. It's so bizarre.
Yeah. I've never seen it, and I don't know if I'm ever going to, so.
Yeah, probably not. Like, the themes of it just aren't going to sit with you.
Yeah. All right, moving on up to 1981, Stevie Nicks goes to number one on the U.S. album charts with Belladonna, featuring the tracks Stop Dragging, My Heart Around, the Tom Petty duet, Leather and Lace with Don Henley, and The Edge of 17, and After the Glitter Fades. Of course, Edge of 17 being one of her super big hits that they still play, like, at Fleetwood Mac shows, so.
Oh, yeah, that's probably one of the biggest, one of her biggest songs that I've ever heard. Although, I will say, Stop Dragging My Heart Around, I hear that one a lot for karaoke, so people still have love in their hearts for Tom Petty.
Just a slightly stab at Stevie Nicks, just a tiny bit.
Uh-oh.
Fairly certain she was sleeping with all of these dudes anyway, so.
Every duet.
Pretty darn sure.
Oh.
How was that a knockdown, man? That should be applauded. What?
Just a little stab. It's okay.
Maybe she likes a little stuff.
Pretty sure all the rest of them were doing the same thing anyway. So,
damn it. 2008.
So, 2008. This falls into my my pick of the week for something interesting. In 2008, a study of more than 36,000 people from around the world concluded that musical taste and personality types were closely related. The research, which was carried out by Professor Adrian North of Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh, suggested that classical music fans were shy, while heavy metal fans were gentle and at ease with themselves. Fans of indie music had low self-esteem and were not hardworking. Fans of rap music had high self-esteem and were outgoing. Country and Western fans were hardworking and outgoing, while reggae fans were creative but not hardworking. And fans of the chart-popping top 40 kind of music had high self-esteem, were not creative, but were hardworking and outgoing.
This is actually extremely interesting. It might have been easy to kind of get lost in that description, but essentially they broke down the different types of music as to personalities. And like, it makes so much sense when you think about it, because I've always wondered like where tastes in music come from, you know, and how like we can have such different tastes in music across the board. You know, and even just people from like the same town, you know, the same upbringing. And yet one loves absolute heavy metal and the other loves country, and that's it. And so I find this really interesting that they would actually break it down like this. Do you guys agree with these? Because some of these seem like pretty good stereotypes to me.
Yeah, I was just going to say, though, to me, this sounds like some kind of like ad that some like grad student wrote and put up on Breitbart. This doesn't sound like a really like.
Well, here's kind of the funny thing for me is that I've always been an eclectic listener.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been. I'll listen to everything that I can. You and I, before we even started recording, I was talking to you about different K-pop artists that I like. I
was literally just going to say that you had the K-pop going.
So I can't explain it. I like K-pop, but at the same time, I like Vladimir Vysotsky in Russia. I like some South African groups, some Australian groups. I follow some Norwegian bands and some Finnish bands too. It's like they cover vastly different styles, vastly different like instruments, even like for some of these different groups. But like for me, I do listen to classical music. I do listen to heavy metal. I do listen to indie music. I don't listen to much rap. I do listen to some country, and I do listen to reggae, and I do listen to chart, you know, pop music.
Well, let's see here. Classical music, they say they're shy. I don't think you're that shy.
I'm definitely not shy.
Heavy metal fans, gentle and at ease. I'd say that's definitely you.
Yeah.
Indie music, low self-esteem, not hardworking. Like, that's the one that, I mean, indie music is...
And I think that, like, for the three of us, like, indie music was a massive part of our lives.
We talk about a lot of indie bands.
Yeah, I mean, like, because we all kind of grew up with that, you know, third wave ska and, like...
Yeah.
And the 90s punk music and stuff like that. I mean, like, that's... We were the indie music scene. Like, but
I guess
I'm definitely not low self-esteem, and you know, I'm a decently working person,
but you know,
I'm not gonna say I'm hardworking, because I'm not that. I know people who work insanely hard. I'm not those people, but at the same time, I ain't stupid lazy when it comes to stuff either. Yeah. So
I mean, I guess indie music, if you think of like Death Cab for Cutie, you know, that kind of feel, that vein, where you can definitely get the, like, the low self-esteem feel from that, talking about some of these deep subjects. But interesting. Rap music, I like that one too. High self-esteem and outgoing. That's awesome, because I mean, that's the whole thing about rap, is about self-promotion.
I can see that too, you that know? it's the culture that's around it.
Mm-hmm.
and you know, I mean, the high levels of self-esteem bordering on insane ego sometimes with some people.
Well, too, and just like going to the gym. You know, a lot of people like, I mean, because even me, I think my preferred music working out is rap, because there's something about the whole, like, I'm the man, I'm going to get it, I'm going to push myself, I'm going to go out and earn it, you know, and so it is. I think it's just the way it ties with the emotions and what it brings up when you hear different types of music is what I'm getting at.
I would honestly like to see more of what this study actually said, because they just covered a few genres, but they didn't actually, they didn't get into like classic rock or that kind of stuff.
This would be a really fun podcast in itself.
Yeah, I'd like to actually see the rest of it. So I'm gonna have to do a little bit of research. But that was my pick for the interesting thing of the week, and I hope you enjoyed it.
That was really interesting. Yes.
All right, let's move on to September 6th. In 1968, working at Abbey Road Studios in London, on the White Album, the Beatles recorded overdubs onto the new George Harrison song, While My Guitar Gently Weeps. And Eric Clapton came in and recorded a guitar solo and became the first famous outside musician to play on a Beatles recording. And of course, George recorded his lead vocal.
Wow.
That's still my favorite George Harrison song.
Great song.
I'm going to say all of my favorite Beatles songs are George Harrison songs.
See, that's the thing that I also like, is that the George Harrison songs that he has done, you know, that were on the albums for the Beatles, ended up being like just really good stuff. And I think that a lot of people know like My Sweet Lord and stuff like that. But if you go back and you listen to what he was actually doing on those albums, he was doing solid vocal work in the background. I mean, just like really good harmony parts and stuff. And it even took my dad, like, you know, 30 plus years of listening to it before he finally realized the part that George was actually singing and being like, wow, he's actually doing like a lot of like great work back there. And I loved that. It's like, you know, even my dad, and he figured it out after watching Hard Day's Night, actually, because he was like, wow, that's kind of amazing that he was singing those parts. So, but yeah, I do love George Harrison's songs, especially more than Ringo's songs.
Oh, nothing against Ringo.
Nothing against Ringo. I'm just saying, Ringo is definitely not a singer. So,
probably. You know what? I'm going to go out on a limb and say Ringo Starr probably the best person out of the four.
No, he's probably the nicest out of the.
That's what I'm saying. He's probably the best person.
So he is also the oldest of the group, which is kind of funny because the two middle ones died. It's like, but now the youngest and the oldest are still alive.
I mean, when you hit 70, like this. An extra year or two really matter?
I'm just saying.
Anyway. This next one seems like a good Greg one.
Go for it.
So 1989, MTV Music Awards. Quite the event. Living Color went in Best Group. And on the stage and backstage, the real action, Vince Neil punching Izzy Stradlin in the face. Axl Rose, of course, overhears the incident. And challenged Neil to fight him, quote, outside. Of course, this would lead to a year-long public feud that amounted to a hill of beans.
Yeah, it was really kind of like the Kanye West Taylor Swift feud of its era.
Beef. Yeah, 1989 beef.
I don't think anyone ever really thought they were going to throw it out and fight. They were just playing it for the publicity.
Back then, they were just saying,
Izzy probably asked for it anyway. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, maybe. I don't
know anything about
Izzy
Stradlin.
The story doesn't make any sense. Like, Vince Neil was like, oh, he took a pass at my wife. But then again, like, Vince Neil
who didn't
have his friends in bed with his wife. So why are you insulted? You're not my friend, Izzy. You don't get to go there. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's all BS.
Just needed a good excuse.
It could have been completely fabricated, too. They could have been like, dude, this is going to be huge. Let's make a feud.
I think so.
Could have been. You never know. So they also could have not told Axel. There's like, dude, let's just play it off. Like, this is real.
I love that. That's you know what? That's how it was.
That's how it was.
He just wasn't in on the joke.
Axel was a pawn in their game.
Yeah.
I love it. All right. Let's go ahead and move on to something slightly sadder.
Yeah.
1997, Elton John recorded a new version of Candle in the Wind while performing the song live at Princess Diana of Wales' funeral. An estimated 2.5 billion people around the world watched Elton John play the special tribute to Diana. The track went on to become the biggest selling single of all time.
Nearly a third of the world.
Yeah.
That's what that number says.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of amazing that it all, like, ended up being that huge.
A third of the world.
I remember that time, so.
Well,
Okay.
So that really all you have to do is just get in all of India to watch it.
Well, that is true. But I mean, that's just 2.5 billion people tuning in for anything is incredible. I mean,
the song became so huge that it became a joke.
Yeah,
that's true.
It was used as the punchline on a King of the Hill joke. When one of the guys goes back and is playing football, and he starts singing the school song, and they said, "That's not the school song anymore." And he goes, "Well, what is it?" You go, "Candle in the Wind" by Elton John.
Yeah.
And he's like, "Oh." That's how big that song was.
Oh.
So there you go. Let's go ahead and move on to the next one. Jake, what you got?
Well, I got something that's out of order, but that's fine, right?
Oh,
who really cares? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, why not?
We're going to jump back to 1976. Frank Sinatra is on the Jerry Lewis Labor Day Telethon, and he brings out a special guest, a friend of his, Dean Martin. It's the first time that Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin shared a stage in 20 years.
Wow.
They brought that up right on stage, but they really kind of looked like they didn't miss a beat, because Jerry immediately looked at Dean after giving him a hug and said, "So you're working?" Which is really funny because, you know, one casino over, Dean Martin had a 20-year run on stage over there of his own show.
So. Yes.
Wow.
Oh, man. Let's see. Going to another depressing one here. Mm-hmm. 1991, Tom Fogerty dies of AIDS, but he contracted AIDS from a blood transfusion at the age of 48.
Yeah. Well, actually, it was a couple of years. He lived with AIDS for a few years. So he died at 48.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that was the end of the sentence there.
Sorry.
Okay, so, but yeah, he, but to get it from a blood transfusion, that's got to be like one nobody of the suckiest things.
Nobody was screening for it then, you know, we're talking about 91.
Yeah.
You know, like, AIDS had only been called AIDS for 2 years.
Yeah.
Like, that was 89.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Autoimmune deficiency syndrome?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it was all over the news and stuff after a while. And I mean, I remember the whole thing about the AIDS epidemic, and all of that. But I remember, like, this story and then I think one other story about somebody getting it from a blood transfusion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that's just got to be, like, the suckiest thing. Is that you're going in, like, you know, for this other reason. It's like getting a blood transfusion, you know, is usually involved in some life-saving process. And then just to find out that basically that one bag of blood is your death sentence.
In this case, he was actually going in for back surgery to have some disc repaired.
Yeah, exactly. So it's brutal. The other one that I heard of about somebody getting it in a blood transfusion was a kid.
Yeah.
Who'd went in like he had some type of injury or something, and then went in and got some blood donated to him and got AIDS that way. But that kid actually survived. He's still alive today. Like he got it like right as the cocktail was created, and then he was, you know, able to continue on to this day. Wow. And actually, I think he fathered a child. Some weird way, like, yeah, like, but the virus was so diminished that he actually was able to father a child accidentally. So,
okay then.
So yeah, it's pretty crazy, but, yep, Tom, you got a bad rap, man. That was pretty bad. So here we go though. Let's move on to something strange.
Okay. Then.
This was my pick.
I'm ready.
This was my pick for weird of the week. A man named Paul Van Valkenburg, from Florida, died of lung cancer. An obituary published in a local paper was picked up by the Associated Press, which ran a short obituary of the dead man, but giving him the wrong name. The real Paul Vance, who was alive and well and living in Coral Springs, Florida, contacted local media after viewing a report of his death on the local TV. He announced that he was still alive and was able to prove this with a stack of royalty checks from ASCAP from his biggest hit, itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini. He told a reporter of the New York Times that his relatives and friends, shocked by the AP report, had called him to check on him after the media all posted his supposed death. Mm-hmm.
Why, yes, I am still alive. Look at all these checks I got coming to me. It'd be a shame if I was dead.
Yeah. So I can just imagine him being like, you know, getting interviewed by the TV or whatever, and he's just like, I am alive. Here's my money.
And I'll take this moment to flash my
dead link. People don't have checks.
Yeah,
duh.
That sounds like a hip-hop fan move. I don't know.
Yeah, but Greg, do I look dead to you? look at it rain.
Yeah, I love the way he says that. Like, they called me to check on me. So like, Greg, whenever I hear terrible news or you're passing on the news, right, you'll be the first one I call.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you would probably call me and try and get a hold of me, right?
Probably not. I'd probably find
Greg Harvey is dead. Bull. Hey.
You're not gonna believe what they're saying about
you. You didn't die, did you? Jerk.
Let's move on to September 7th. Mm-hmm. 1936, born on this day, Buddy Holly, of course, the singer, the songwriter, and the all-around awesome guy. Of course, he formed the band The Crickets with him, and in 1957 had a U.S. number one hit, That'll Be the Day, and then in 1959 had a U.K. number one single, It Doesn't Matter Anymore, plus other 15 other U.K. top 40 singles, and had a bunch of U.S. top 40 singles. He influenced the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and a thousand other bands, and to this day is still influencing people. But Holly was unfortunately killed in the plane crash on February 3rd, 1959, along with the Big Bopper and Richie Valens. And of course, that was the day the music died.
Yeah, 19-year-old Richie Valens. I still can't get over that.
Yeah, that was pretty crazy. But happy birthday to Buddy Holly. He was a great individual.
And a pioneer of glasses in rock and roll.
Yes. Yes, he was. And now, of course, he's famous because of a Weezer song.
Yes.
Yeah, kind of.
Because everybody's like, Wii U, I look just like Buddy Holly. And then there's a bunch of people who are just like, who's Buddy Holly?
You know what? Let's bring that up right now.
You want
to? That's later. 1994, Weezer releases the single Buddy Holly.
Yep,
on which Buddy is Holly's kind of amazing. Birthday.
On his birthday, yeah.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Wow.
I thought that was pretty nice.
It's a good way to footnote it.
Well, I can do this one.
Go ahead, because this is right in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, 1964, born on this day from the group NWA, and of course from his own thing, Eazy-E.
Because the boys in the hood are always hard.
Come talking that trash and we'll pull your card. Well, nothing in life but to be legit.
Now, of course, Eazy-E has gained a lot more of a following after the recent movie that came out.
Yes.
And the guy who played Eazy-E in the movie. Straight Outta Compton. Yes. Mm-hmm. It was a fantastic film. But the guy who played Eazy-E in there did a fantastic job. And, like, he looked a lot like Eazy-E, which was kind of impressive. Mm. So that dude and the dude who played Tupac, like, looked exactly like those characters.
Oh, yeah. That was a good movie. But happy birthday to Eazy-E, both successful as a solo artist and with the group NWA, and unfortunately another victim of AIDS.
Yes, yes. And I'm pretty sure he didn't contract it from blood transfusion.
Pretty sure that was drugs.
You don't know that.
It was either drugs or the women, so you never know, though.
Yeah. You don't know that.
You don't know that.
Well, of course, they address it in the movie.
Yes, they do. Yeah. They address him having AIDS in there as well, so... Man, I just realized this, though. We've had a couple of AIDS deaths, because we had Eazy-E was born and died of AIDS. Tom Fogerty died of AIDS on that day. Yep. Freddie Mercury died of AIDS. Yeah, yeah. It's like, and we talked about him. It's like, man, we had several AIDS deaths this week. Yep. That is not cool. They're all kind of like, they all kind of happen like in a fairly close proximity to each other.
Well, that was the '90s. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
early '80s and '90s. Yeah. That was the height of the AIDS epidemic. So,
And not a lot of understanding then too.
Yeah.
You know, even in the movie, Eazy-E, he exclaims, you know, he found out he had AIDS, and he exclaimed, he had to justify to everybody, "I'm not gay."
Yeah, because everybody thought that it was just amongst the gay community.
Yeah, I mean, and especially, you got to imagine, to put it in today's terms, like if Drake or Kendrick Lamar are like a really respected rapper, you know, and that was the thing, was suddenly like, oh, Drake has AIDS and he must be gay. And it's like, well, no. But that's the perception back then for somebody like Eazy-E, who was like a gangster rapper and highly respected. To have that script flipped on him in a terrible time.
Yeah.
You know, but then to also have to deal with the stigma of it as well. Tragic way for Eazy-E to go.
Yeah. So let's move on to another tragic death that is not AIDS related.
One we talk about a lot.
Yes, that is true. So why don't you do this one, Jake?
Sure thing. 1978, Keith Moon, the drummer for The Who, dies of an overdose of what I thought was like every substance on the planet, or would have assumed. But it turns out it was actually prescription medicine called Hemavirin, which was he was using to treat his alcoholism. So if you don't know, if you're a real alcoholic, like the kind of person who like wakes up from like an 8-hour, 10-hour sleep and you have the shakes because you don't have enough booze in your system, if you just stop drinking, you can die. Like if you quit cold turkey.
Yes.
You can die. So Hemavirin is a prescription drug that's used to keep you from not dying. However, after going to a party the night before that was organized by Paul McCartney and watching the premiere of the Buddy Holly movie, Keith Moon kind of screwed up and took too many tablets or pills. Maybe, who knows what happened, really, how he ended up doing it. But the autopsy said there was something like 32 tablets in his system. So,
And 26 of them were undissolved.
Oh, yeah. So he just took them all.
So he just kept taking them.
Yeah. All right, then. So I guess somebody does know. So, Keith Moon, crazy influential drummer.
The Who,
stupid important band in rock and roll.
Yeah, famous. I mean, if you think of somebody like destroying their drum set, like kicking it over, you know, and just smashing the heck out of it, he was kind of famous for being the wild man.
So then here's my question, though. Does this death also fall onto the head of Buddy Holly?
The day the music died, man.
Because if it wasn't for his movie coming out, would he have been on that bender that night?
Maybe there's like some weird...
Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure it was...
I'm pretty sure he would have died at some point in time in the near future,
right.
But...
The guy who accidentally drove a car into a pool at a hotel during a birthday party, the guy who put explosives in his drum and then just sat there when it exploded,
And gave his friend permanent hearing loss because of it. And also sent shrapnel of cymbals into his arm.
Yes.
Yeah, good to know. I blame Paul McCartney for hosting the party. That's all I'm saying.
All right. Mm-hmm.
I'm kidding. 1985. I don't know why I really put this on here, but I did anyway.
Okay.
David Bowie and Mick Jagger were at number one on the UK singles chart with their version of Martha Reeves and the Vandellas' 1964 hit, Dancing in the Street. It's a horrible rendition of that song. It honestly is horrible. Like, I know David Bowie and Mick Jagger, big rock stars and everything. It is a horrible version of that song. But it was recorded in part for the Live Aid charity. The original plan was to perform the track together live with Bowie performing at Wembley Stadium and Jagger performing at JFK Stadium until the tech people were involved. And they said, that's impossible. The satellite uplink will have at least a half second, 2 second delay. Which means that the only way that you could actually play it is if you had everybody playing the click track and you just weirdly timed it perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, it still wouldn't really work because then it going back to the... just doesn't work.
Yeah.
So fortunately, there was a sound guy when they asked him, like, hey, can we do this? He was just like... No.
The end.
There you go.
I do want to say one thing. By the way, there's this, to bring it back to 2017 here, there's like a YouTube channel that they do, I think, called Songs Without Music. And the best viral video I've ever seen is this song's music video, where they take out the music and just put in just the sound effects and the impersonations of them singing. And so it's just like the music video just starts out with Mick Jagger and his sound of his feet on the concrete, like dancing in the street.
Okay.
And it's just like a quiet night, like they're just dancing around a warehouse with no music. Check it out. That's all I'm saying.
So
it is hilarious.
I do actually know what you're talking about. They also did one for 21 Pilots dressed out, and it was honestly one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
That's what I'm saying. So see it. You got to see this one, though, for Mick Jagger and David Bowie.
It's exactly that, because like they put in sound effects like where music normally there wasn't anything. And so like on Stressed Out, when he's riding the tricycle down the street, they literally just had like the tricycle rolling down the street, like, you know.
Well, and they only leave the vocals in when you can actually see the artist's mouth moving.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so if they're standing in front of the camera singing, it's like, you know, dancing in the, and it'll like cut to the street and it'll just be like dancing in the, and then cut and it's silent, just chirp, chirp, chirp. And then it'll cut back to David Bowie and he's like, everyone around the world.
So yeah, check those out. They're legitimately funny things to watch on
so
the YouTube.
We can laugh at their pain.
So, Jake.
Yes.
Apparently we had a lot of deaths in this episode.
Yes, we did.
So, this isn't exactly a death, but it leads to the
death.
Yes,
it does. It gets really close. But before that.
What do you got?
Did you know? Okay, so Michael Jackson released.
Oh, yeah. Let's do that one first.
Michael Jackson released Bad in 1987 on this day, the album Bad.
Boom.
Did you know that during recording, Michael Jackson had approached Prince at doing a dual album?
A duet? A duel?
Bad was intended to be an album of Michael Jackson and Prince.
That's cool.
Huh. Why did Prince turn it down?
Because he's Prince, man.
I guess I could see that. I mean, in that point, I mean, you're talking about like basically a musical genius, like teaming up with somebody who, you know, is
the king of pop.
He's the king of pop.
Yes.
That's true. But at the same time, I mean, like, we all know it was Quincy that made him the superstar.
True. Yes.
That he is.
Yeah, no doubt.
So, you know, he was talented. Mm-hmm. He was a talented singer, talented performer. But he wasn't, like, the musical genius behind what he did. But he was an extremely good choreographer, actually. That was the one thing that I definitely got to give to Michael
Jackson.
Here's
what I'm going to say. All right, so I read a small article on this that was like a lot of rumors and interviews of people who knew other people.
Yes.
Because the article was written last year. So Quincy Jones, Michael Jackson, and Prince were all dead by then, right?
But Quincy's not dead.
Quincy's not dead?
No, Quincy's still alive.
Well, then they didn't talk to Quincy.
I guess not.
I was reading the article assuming that he was no longer with us.
No.
My bad. Quincy.
No.
Hey, so love you, buddy.
The other two.
Yes.
Michael Jackson and Prince are definitely dead. Okay. Quincy is still very much alive because he was in that really bad Adam Sandler movie on Netflix, Sandy Wexler.
Oh.
And Adam Sandler kept calling him Quincilius.
I haven't seen it. Because
he said that was his name. So.
My bad.
It's not that bad. It's a decent film, but it's not.
Okay.
It's not great Sandler movie. That's all I'm trying to say.
Okay. So anyway, Quincy. The whole draw for Prince was to work with Quincy Jackson.
Quincy Jones.
God.
Quincy Jones. Michael Jackson.
Yes, Michael Jackson was to work with Quincy Jones, and I guess there was possibly some like his label didn't want him to do it, because like contracts and they didn't want to split money, even though it would have been the biggest thing ever.
That is true.
So I guess in answer to your question of why did he turn him down, it's because the world wanted it.
Okay, I could see that.
Okay. So anyway.
Okay.
All right.
1996.
Yes.
Tupac Shakur is shot 5 times outside of Suge Knight's Club 662. Early in the night, Tupac and Knight had attended the Tyson Sheldon fight at the MGM Grand, where one of his entourage had spotted Orlando Anderson, a Crips gang member known as Baby Lane. The Death Row entourage then assaulted Baby Lane in the MGM casino, where it was filmed by surveillance cameras. This attack was reportedly in retaliation for a robbery at a Foot Locker perpetrated by Baby Lane.
Later, at roughly 11 p.m., while inside Shook Knight's BMW 750IL, a white Cadillac pulled up beside the death row crew and opened fire on the vehicle. Tupac and Knight were both rushed and taken to University Medical Center of Southern Nevada, where Tupac was placed under a medical-induced coma to prevent him from interfering with his own treatment. Apparently, he refused to stay in bed and kept pulling out IVs and trying to remove his bandages. But before he was placed into that medical coma, and just shortly before the drugs took hold, an officer tried to take a statement from him, and Tupac's last words were reported as, "Fuck you."
To the cop.
Yep.
Of course it was. I looked a little bit more into the story,
yes,
and found out that the shots that actually killed him were the one through his chest, one,
yes,
went through his lung, and another one went through his leg,
mm-hmm,
and actually like shot him in the left testicle, apparently.
Ooh. Wow.
And so like I mean, it really kind of messed him up. Like the angle that they said that it went in and stuff, because it was, I don't think it was just a regular, I don't think it was like a Cadillac. I think it was like a Cadillac, kind of like, not an Escalade, but like something bigger, like kind of like a sport utility vehicle.
Every report I saw called it at the time a late model Cadillac, which would be a new Cadillac.
Okay, so maybe, yeah, that's maybe I'm wrong. But yeah, they said that like the angle of the, mm-hmm, shots and stuff were like just devastated,
yeah,
him.
Well, you also don't know how he moved in the car when shots started.
Yeah.
And you don't know, that car might have had a sunroof somebody was standing up in.
Yeah, it could have been.
Maybe, you know.
And I also know that Suge Knight caught a ricochet in, yes, the head.
Yeah.
And basically just had to have that removed.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. So, you know, Tupac, he was in the hospital, I think, for another 4 or 5 days. And
yeah,
then he started having complications and internal bleeding. And surgeons rushed to try and work on him. That's part of the reason they put him in the medically induced coma.
Yeah.
Was because his moving around was
causing more damage.
Was really causing a lot of damage. He needed to be completely immobile.
Yes.
Anyway, so they worked on him for 2 or 3 hours, I think, to try and repair it and just couldn't. So that was when his mother made the decision to take him off life support. So, you know, the medical team worked really hard on him. I mean, no criticisms there. There's been plenty of criticism on, like, the investigating officers afterwards.
Yeah.
Saying that this should be a pretty easy open and shut case to find someone.
Yeah. I know that, on a weird side note, mm-hmm, that the car, actually, that they were driving, the BMW.
Yes.
Somebody shot out one of the tires, and Suge Knight actually drove the car for another mile down the road before finally, like, stopping a bike cop or something.
Yeah.
And then that person called in for the ambulance and that kind of stuff, too. It was really just, I mean, it was a crazy situation anyway.
Well, okay, so 5 minutes before the shooting, they were actually pulled over.
Yeah.
By a bicycle cop.
Mm.
That same bicycle cop. He stopped them because Suge Knight's car didn't have any plates on it.
Oh, of course it didn't.
Right. So he talked to him for a little bit, recognized Tupac, said, "Oh, hey, I'm a big fan." And Suge Knight was like, "Oh, man, I got the plates in the trunk." And the guy's like, "All right, cool, see ya." And then they drove about a block away. And then the shooting took place. So they actually, Knight's BMW actually spun around and drove back to that same bike cop.
Wow.
Anyway.
So there you go.
Pretty nuts. The only thing I can say after that is that there's a really big story about Outlaws, the group, smoking joints that were laced with Tupac's ashes.
Hmm.
And I found a recent interview where a couple of the members from Outlaws said, "Yeah, we did that, but it turns out that the guy who brought it to us was, like, didn't know Tupac. He was just a crackhead, and he told me later, those were ashes out of a barbecue pit."
Right?
So there you go.
Which is, like, really dumb anyway, because you can't smoke ashes. Like, they're kind of already burnt.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway.
Wow. So, yeah, September 7th, 1996, Tupac was shot several times, and a few days later ended up dying. Or did he?
Right? People think he's still alive.
Dun, dun, dun.
There have been some really good doppelgangers, though.
And now he's a hologram.
So,
moving on up to 2000, Tim Comerford, of Rage Against the Machine climbed the backdrop at the MTV Music Awards to disrupt Limp Bizkit as they accepted the award for Best Rock Video. Of course, they were also nominated for a video for that one. And it was reported that, not reported, it was then afterwards that Fred Durst said, anyway, this is pretty fat.
PH fat.
Yes. And that's it, because that's all I care to say about Fred Durst. Although I have seen some recent photos of him. Dude is rocking the beard.
Okay, then.
Like, he's like, full-on, like, Civil War beard at this point. So
you never had a beard grow it out once. Just try it once. See what you got.
A Civil War beard?
No, I'm just anybody out there.
Like what you got, Jake?
Anyone out there that doesn't have a beard that has never tried it.
I figured you might try to go for General Burnside's one time.
General Burnside's, yeah.
Just to, like, the giant.
I'm going to take off the mustache.
The giant mutton
and
job.
And have one of those whaler beards that just goes just on the chin outline.
Oh, I thought that was just called the noose.
I don't know, maybe.
Save it for the beard podcast.
The beard podcast. I thought you just shave this part and then, like, just have, like, the mustache and then, like, that connects to the sideburns. You seen those?
Yeah, that's hideous.
I know.
You guys should be here to see these beards.
I mean, you've got some facial hair going now, too. I mean, you don't...
I grew it out for about a month and a half last month, and then it just got... Like, it's terrible when it's still growing out. It doesn't look good, but then it's also patchy. But it's in that phase where even if it wasn't patchy, it's still just in the bad phase. And even my loving, supporting girlfriend was like, okay, no.
All right, Jake, what you got for us?
September 8th. We're going to go back to 1897.
Of course we are.
Yes, because the singing brakeman, James Charles Rogers is born in Meridian, Mississippi, or Geiger, Alabama, or yet still Springs, Mississippi. Nobody really knows. That's the thing. Like, the problem is that there's like four entries in the 1900 census for his mother that puts her in four different towns in two different states.
Wow.
But either way, Jimmy Rogers, hugely influential as a very early country recording artist. If you don't know who he is, he makes sounds like a train. He can make train sounds too, because he was a railroad worker, and that's the thing that people do. They imitate trains. Because you're on a railroad, and there's nothing around because you're on a railroad.
It's the only, right? The only music is the chug, chug, chug of that train.
Right. Woo! Anyhow, I know him best for In the Jailhouse Now.
He's in the jailhouse now. He's in the jailhouse now.
Yeah.
Well, I told him once or twice to stop playing cards and shooting dice. He's in the jailhouse now.
There you go. So, yeah, Jimmy Rogers, one of the yodeling country artists.
Yes, that is true. There's a great yodeling part in that song. So, all right, moving on up to another great country artist, 1932, born on this day, Patsy Cline. Of course, her hits began in 1957 with Don Hex and Alan Block's Walkin' After Midnight, which is one of my all-time favorite country songs. Moving on after that to Hank Cochran's and Harlan Howard's I Fall to Pieces and Willie Nelson's Crazy. And ended in 1963 with Don Gibson's Sweet Dreams. She died at the age of 30 on the 5th of March, 1963, at the height of her career in a plane crash. She was one of the most influential and successful and acclaimed female vocalist of the 20th century. 10 years after her death in 1973, she became the first female solo artist inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. There was something special about her voice.
There was. Her also, I found out her dad, bit of a creeper.
I'm sure he was.
41, blacksmith, wife, seamstress. 16 when Patsy was born.
Jeez.
Well, it's a different world back in 1932. World.
It's a different world. That is absolutely true. Greg, give us the next one.
Oh, I love this one.
This one's great. 1955. In an attempt to hide the wrinkles in his suit, Chuck Berry does the duck walk for the first time.
I like it.
oh, my suit is all wrinkly. I'm just going to go with it. See, that's the ultimate, like, that's the performer's credo right there. It's the show must go on.
Yeah.
My suit is wrinkled. Check this out. Now I'm just doing a crazy dance. That's the perfect bait and switch, too.
All right. Moving on up after that. 1968, the Beatles performed Hey Jude on the UK television show Frost on Sunday in front of an invited audience. The song was the first single from the Beatles record label Apple Records. And at over 7 minutes in length, Hey Jude was at the time the longest single ever to top the British charts. Also spent 9 weeks at number one in the U.S. and the longest run at the top of the American charts for any Beatles single.
Hey Jude,
yeah,
was the best American single that the Beatles had, according to that.
Yeah. Hmm. I get it, though. That's a great song.
It is a great song. Yeah.
But...
It's just interesting.
It is interesting. But moving on to the next one.
Oh, okay.
Another great hit here. Mm-hmm. 1973, Marvin Gaye started a 2-week run at number one on the U.S. singles chart with Let's Get It On. Mm-mm. Oh, baby, let's get it on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was only his second U.S. number one, but only reached 31 in the U.K.
They're not feeling the love.
They were not feeling they were not wanting to get it on.
Yeah.
I'm sure the upper crust British people were just like, you know, like, how dare he? How dare he tell us to get it on?
Yeah, yeah. It definitely offending those British sensibilities. I'm sure if it was something of an understatement as to
if,
like,
it was more of an innuendo.
Yes, like if this woman gives me a certain feeling by the trousers, it would have.
I just imagine somebody.
That's not catchy, but I mean.
I see a British person, like, in the record store picking it up, like, let's get it on. Let's not.
It's like, but if he'd named it the original title of Let's Do the Horizontal Tango, then it might have done a little bit better.
That innuendo is too blunt. It's
the Diagonal Mambo. Okay.
Our next one, Greg. This requires radio voice.
Okay. Oh, okay.
From you?
From you.
No, from you.
From me?
Go ahead.
You're the professional here.
Thanks, Jake. Thanks for that.
In the year 1994, the world shares a collective gag as Michael Jackson and Lisa Marie Presley share a kiss on live television.
I mean, everyone remembers where they were when that happened, right?
That was weird. I get it, but yeah, that was just weird. Michael Jackson was just a weird dude in general, but that was just a weird situation. And then she showed up in that music video.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. What a strange time. Let's end this entire shindig on something amazing, though. And by amazing, I mean mildly interesting. In 2002, Iron Maiden singer Bruce Dickinson, I have seen Bruce Dickinson perform live, that dude is amazing, started his new job as an airline pilot. The heavy metal singer qualified as a 35,000-pound, 8-year first officer with the Gatwick-based airline Astraeus, and basically they just flew people to Portugal and Egypt.
Wow. Wait a minute. In 2002.
Yes. One of the greatest.
This is your
heavy
captain
metal
speaking. The
rock,
lead singer of Iron Maiden.
Like, yes. He went on. He loved being a pilot. And so he was like, why not? I'll go ahead and do it. I got some downtime. I'll qualify to be an actual airline pilot. And so he did. And there's pictures of him. You can find him online wearing his little outfit and stuff too. Just cracks me up because then he would like fly, and then like you know do all that, and then be like, "All right, I gotta go on tour now. I'll be back in a year."
Hello, this is your captain speaking. Dun, 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 dun. Fasten your seat belts.
All right, folks. This has been our lovely little This Week in Music History for September 4th through the 8th. I hope you enjoyed our little tidbits, our little factoids, our little dive into this world of music history. I thought we had a lot of great, interesting ones, some great discussions.
Very quirky.
It was a very quirky day. We had some great births. We had some weird deaths. Had a bunch of AIDS deaths for some reason. But we don't plan these things out. These are just the things that happened this week. And we just try to pick and choose what we happen to like. But hopefully you guys enjoyed this. Once again, if you want to help out the show, you can do that stuff that I said earlier by going to the website and clicking on the Amazon banner. Go to followthesoundpodcast.com and then click on the Amazon banner. Or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. It's really stupid, and it's stupid easy, and it helps us out. So there's that. Also want to thank lineupmedia.fm for allowing us to do the show. Of course, we wouldn't be doing the show without them. So if you want to go check out all of the other great programs that we have, go to lineupmedia.fm, and you can find all sorts of different things out there. It's a great place to just find interesting topics to listen to. Of course, you can listen to This Day in History, which is hosted by Tony Hubert and Armand Kachigian. And those guys go through all different stuff every day, podcast every day that they're in the office. And it's just really, really good. Check them out at thisdayinhistorypodcast.com and enjoy. But for me, I have been your host, Brian Kroc, and along with me has been Jacob Crum.
I feel the magic in your caress. I feel the magic when I feel your dress. Silk and satin, leather and lace, black panties, and an angel face. Thank you, Diana Ross.
And of course, Greg Harvey.
Happy birthday, Bubba.
If you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.